Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tattered Cover. First, I'd like to thank you all for coming out and supporting your local and independent bookstore. Tonight, I am excited to introduce Adriana Lisboa as our guest of honor this evening. Adriana is an award-winning author and Brazilian native whose literary works consist of novels, poetry, short stories, and children's books. Tonight, she will discuss and sign her new book, Crow Blue. It's a gripping story of family and self-discovery. So without further delay, please help me welcome Adriana Lisboa.
Thank you so much, and good evening, everyone. Boa noite. Good to see you all. Well, I'm gonna say a few words about the book, about the plot, and then I'm gonna read a little bit from it. Well, Crow Blue is a story. It's narrated by a Brazilian woman, a young woman, who leaves Brazil, who leaves Rio, and comes to live in Lakewood, Colorado, when she's 13. She loses her mother, and she comes to look for her biological father, whom she's never met. And the story is narrated a few years later. In this process, she becomes friends, so to speak, with her mother's former husband, who also happened to be a guerrilla, a communist guerrilla, during the late 60s and early 70s in Brazil. So the second plot, sort of a subplot to the book, is the story of this communist guerrilla that happened in the jungle in Brazil, in the Amazon jungle. And it's a very obscure and controversial episode of the Brazilian recent history. There's still a lot of many secrets around this episode. It was a really almost unbelievable kind of event where there was the military dictatorship in Brazil at the time, and the military had to send about 5,000 troops to the forest to hunt down and eventually kill less than 100 guerrillas. So it's quite a story, and this is also narrated in the book through a fictional character, this girl's stepfather. He's a fictional character, but inspired by a real someone that really lived. So I'm going to do something that I. Oh, there's something also that's interesting. Well, this book is, as you probably know, originally written in Portuguese. And it was wonderfully translated into English by this great, great, I'm very lucky to have her as a translator, Alison Entrekin. And today is actually the Translator's Day, so it's good to be here talking about the book with this wonderful translation done by Alison. So I'm going to read just a paragraph in Portuguese. So you can just have an idea of how it sounds in the original, and then I'm going to move on and read the chapter 2 of the book in English. Foi ela quem me ensinou inglês e espanhol. Era o que ela sabia fazer. Se fosse professora de yoga, teria passado 12 anos me ensinando yoga. E se trabalhasse na lavoura, eu teria uma enxada antes mesmo de aprender a falar. Era o que ela sabia fazer, e achava um desperdício não deixar para mim, de graça, como herança em vida, qualquer conhecimento que fosse. So this is the narrator, Vanja, talking about her mother, her deceased mother. She was the one who had taught me English and Spanish. It was what she knew how to do. If she'd been a yoga teacher, she'd have spent 12 years teaching me yoga. And if she'd worked on the land, I'd have a hoe before I'd even learned to talk. It was what she knew how to do, and she thought it was a waste not to pass on to me for free as an inheritance some kind of law knowledge. It was English and Spanish because she'd lived in the United States, in Texas and New Mexico for 22 years. And if there is one thing that 22 years in a place will impose on you, it is the mastery of the local language, even if you don't have any special talent for it. My mother had learned English formally at school, Spanish informally with the Tejanos. And I learned both from my mother, submitting to her lessons with a resistance that was never any match for hers, as el televisor, no señor, señorita, señora, no es el televisor, es el gato. Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits, and their names were Flopsy, Mopsy, Cottontail, and Peter. Later on, I saw Peter Rabbit in supermarkets at Easter. I remembered my mother. I also remembered Flopsy, Mopsy, and Cottontail, who were very little good rabbits and thus escaped life's punishments, though they lacked Peter's heroic charm. The mothers in my family die young. By the age of 9, my mother had lost her mother and gone to Texas with her geologist father, a work opportunity for him, which he'd gotten through his contacts. My mother grew up in Texas. One day, she never told me why, and somehow I didn't think I should ask. She severed ties with her father and moved to New Mexico. My mother liked severing ties with men and disappearing from their lives. The tendency began there with my geologist grandfather. She found a little house in Albuquerque near Route 66 with its old-fashioned charm, more than a decade before I was born. One of those little adobe houses with a flat roof resting on wooden beams that ran horizontally through the walls. She still lived in this house when I was born. We lived there until I was 2. I visited it much later with Fernando and Carlos, my improbable pair of travel companions, one icy November day. It was a small house of the most absolute simplicity, as if it had sprung from the ground itself. My mother also taught Spanish to Americans. University students sometimes sought her out. Some, very few, wanted to learn Portuguese. By this time, it was the least fluent of her 3 languages. But because of her students, she delved into Brazilian music and films and books. The few Americans interested in Brazil made my mother rediscover Brazil, perhaps a little clumsily at first, with the awkwardness of the prodigal child who returns home with their hands in their pockets and drooping ears, but who, short time after, are crossing their feet on the table and flicking cigarette butts into corners. I don't remember my early childhood in Albuquerque, of course. When I travel back in time, it feels as though I was born in Rio de Janeiro, more specifically on Copacabana Beach, right there on the sand, among the pigeons and the litter left behind by beachgoers. I think of Copacabana. I close my eyes, and even if I'm listening to acoustic Arabia and burning Japanese Zen Buddhist temple incense, what reaches my senses is a faint whiff of sea breeze, a faint taste of fruit popsicles mixed with sand and salt water, and the sound of the waves fizzing on the sand and the popsicle vendor's voice under the moist Rio sun. I remember the light, my fingers digging tunnels and building castles in the wet sand patiently. There were other children around, but we were all the beginning, middle, and end of our own private universes. So I was born at the age of 2 on Copacabana Beach, and it was always summer, but a summer wedded to water, and my tools for changing the world, for altering it and shaping it and making it worthy of me, were a little red bucket and a yellow sieve, spade, and rake. And further along was a horizon to which I gave no thought, the imaginary line where the sky and sea parted company, liquid to one side, not liquid to the other, a kind of concrete abstract. I left the horizon in peace and preferred to dream of islands which were real, and which maybe I'd be able to swim to if I ever got serious about swimming, and which were separated by a world of different shadows, a world where speeds and sounds were different, where animals very different to me lived, a world of fish, of algae, of mollusks, of crow blue shells, like those I would read in a poem much later. A whole other life, another register, but a human being could actually swim between them, observe them, dive to the ocean floor in Copacabana and touch the intimacy of the sand there, so far from the popsicle sticks and volleyballs and empada vendors. The intimacy that was completely alien to the usual chaos of the neighborhood of Copacabana, where people hurried along or dawdled with the elderly gait of the retired, or mugged, or got mugged, or queued at the bank, or lifted weights at the gym, or begged at traffic lights, or pretended not to see people begging in traffic lights, or looked at the pretty woman, or were the pretty woman with the tiny triangles of her bikini top, or tallied up prices on the supermarket cash register, or picked up litter from the sidewalks and streets, or tossed litter on the sidewalks and streets, or sold sex to tourists, or wrote poems, or walked their dogs. The drama of the city didn't even figure in the subconscious of the ocean floor. It wasn't important or relevant. It didn't exist there. The horizon was the theme of those who yearned for the impossible. So they could keep on yearning, I guess. I've always thought it was complacent to search for something you're never going to find. Pondering the poetry and symbolism of the horizon wasn't for me. I preferred to ponder islands and fish. Or, better yet, the architecture of the castle I was building that morning, which was not going to crumble this time. I was making some improvements to the project, which had already failed several times. There were children and adults around me. I was aware of their existence, more or less peripherally. We could get along well if we didn't bother one another, if we interacted as little as possible. The beach was large and free of charge. The sun was for everyone. In Rio, my mother also taught English and Spanish and Portuguese to foreigners. She said it was a wild card profession, and she said it like she meant it. Anywhere in the world, there will always be people wanting to learn English and/or Spanish. And Portuguese would increase its sphere of influence after Brazil showed the world what it was made of. "You'll live to see it," she'd say, straightening her back and lifting her chin as she spoke, as if defying the very air in front of her to contradict her. When we went to live in Brazil, she became a nationalist, an advocate of all things Brazilian, among them the language we had inherited from our European colonizer and acclimatized, and which she came to consider the most beautiful in the world. My mother and I never returned to Albuquerque together. In fact, we never returned to the United States together. Firstly, because she no longer got paid in U.S. dollars for her lessons. And in Brazil, human resources were pretty cheap, even perfect trilingual human resources. So the trip was too expensive for our new green and yellow, more or less underpaid pockets. Secondly, because my mother wasn't one to retrace her steps. When she left, she left. When she walked out, she walked out. In the long summer holidays, we would always went to Barra do Jucu in the state of Espírito Santo, where my mother had friends. We'd climb into her Fiat 147, and some 7 hours later, we'd arrive, weary and happy. And along the way, my mother would listen to music and sing along. My mother would play Janis Joplin and turn up the volume and stick her head out the window of the Fiat and sing along. "Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose." Even when I didn't understand the words, I was hypnotized by my mother's trance. She seemed like another woman, which fascinated and frightened me. Her voice had a hoarseness exactly like Janis Joplin's. And I wonder why some people became Janis Joplin and others became my mother. "You sing just as well as Janis Joplin," I once told her. the only thing we have in common is that her dad worked for Texaco, she replied. You know, oil. When I was informed that Janis Joplin had died in 1970, almost two decades before I was born, I was indignant. I had thought Janis Joplin was my contemporary and that she was singing me and Bobby McGee somewhere on the planet, while my mother, who was everything Janis Joplin hadn't been, who was her opposite, her antimatter in another dimension, was sticking her head out the window of the car that wasn't a Porsche painted in psychedelic colors and belting out what she could to the scalding hot asphalt of the highway. My mother's friends in Barra do Jucu also had young kids. We liked to watch the crabs in the mangrove swamp right behind the house. The crabs held a terrible fascination for me. Though horrified and disgusted, I couldn't keep my eyes off their slow, muddy walk, those lone monks in their long meditative trances. The other kids and I changed from pajamas into beachwear and from beachwear into pajamas after a hose down at the end of each day. Someone always butted in with a bar of soap and a bottle of shampoo. Growing up is a drag. But I was violently happy there and returned from Barra do Jucu when the holidays were over with the skin the color of dark wood, almost like the jacaranda table in our living room. Elisa used to call me her little caramel girl. Elisa was my mother's foster sister. My family's genealogy is confusing and simple at the same time. My grandmother brought up Elisa as if she were her own daughter. Later, my mother was born, and then my grandmother died, and when my mother went to Texas with my grandfather, Elisa stayed in Rio. She was all grown up, 16 years old, and had a job and a fiancé who would never become her husband, but it was a fiancé nonetheless, which was better than nothing. Unlike his Rio daughter, she never severed ties with the man who had brought her up, though she never saw him again either, because there was an entire continent between them. And when my retired geologist Brazilian grandfather died of a Texan snakebite on Texan soil at the age of 67, she was the one who broke the news to my mother, all the way from the southern hemisphere. Elisa was the daughter who had accidentally sprang from the womb of my mother's maid. There was no father in the picture. The mother died in childbirth. I'll bring her up, said my grandmother, and that was how Elisa came into my family. But she should always be the maid's daughter, and this original sin, this hybridism with the dark world of the servant class in a caste system deeply rooted in Brazilian society from day one, set her apart from my mother, who went to the United States while Elisa stayed behind after my grandmother's death. If she nursed any hurt feelings, like tiny secret jewels at the bottom of a drawer, she never let on to me. Later, she studied to be a nurse and got a job in the public service and broke off her engagement because her fiancé kept stalling. According to Elisa, it was better to be alone than in a dead-end relationship. As for me, when someone asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, the only thing that occurred to me were occupations that took place on a strip of sand with waves breaking against it. Empada vendor? Thus, the years spent in Copacabana and Barra do Jucu with the powerful machine known as the Fiat 147 suited me 100%. And except for a living Janis Joplin, I wanted for nothing ever. But there were still Spanish and English lessons. This way, you'll get work anywhere in the world, my mother used to say, and I'd mentally recite, es el televisor, no señor, señora, señorita, no es el televisor, es el gato. I didn't want to work anywhere in the world explaining to people that cats were in TVs, but putting up resistance to the transmission / imposition of knowledge was pointless. My mother told me stories about her mother, about her father. She said only the barest minimum. I imagined my grandmother as a very thin woman with tiny feet who collected postcards from places with suggestive names like Hanover and Islamabad. She had a cat that lay in her lap and bit everyone else, an eccentric cat who preferred his teeth to his claws. One day the cat fell out the apartment window and died, splayed across the sidewalk. People said the cat committed suicide. My mother told me she told them cats don't commit suicide. How do you know? I asked her. Cats don't commit suicide, she responded. I imagined my grandfather in a cowboy hat selling his geological knowledge to oil companies in Texas, and one day getting bitten by a lethal rattlesnake called Crotalus atrox. He had a blue suit jacket and a roll of fat at the nape of his neck. This was my family tree until I was 13 years old. One man and four women across three generations. Odd arithmetic tied up like colorful handkerchiefs inside a magician's top hat. A family tree lacking roots, which in the place of certain branches only had vague gestures, indications, suggestions. Forget about it. If you look at it from another point of view, however, things were very simple. After all, sometimes people vanish, but sometimes other people go looking for them. They pull their colorful handkerchiefs out of their top hats, dragging out rabbits, doves, and even a burning torch to the audience's astonishment. The day I arrived from Brazil, I hung the clothes I had in the closet. There weren't many. In the front entrance of Fernando's house in Lakewood, Colorado, there was a closet for coats and shoes. I put Elisa's heels, which I was never going to use, in it. The heels half closed their eyes, and there they stayed, like a Hindu ascetic going to meditate in a cave. When you come inside, take your shoes off, Fernando told me. That way the house stays clean for longer. Then he went to his room and came back with a bag. Here, Evangelina, I bought these for you. They're to wear around the house. In the bag was a pair of checkered slippers that were fleecy on the inside. I thought they looked like granny slippers, but I didn't say anything. They're not for now, of course, he said. They're for when it gets cold. You can call me Vanja, I said. Fernando's house had two bedrooms. He got the sofa bed ready for me in the spare bedroom. Later on, we'll have to buy you a coat and some boots, he said. There's a shop with some good stuff at the outlet, but it doesn't have to be right away. It didn't have to be ever. It was unimaginable that at some point I was going to feel cold there. Boots? He had got to be kidding. But contrary to all of my expectations and everything that pointed to a new world 100% untouched in its desert rigidity, it started to rain every now and again. The first rain fell during the night. I woke up and everything was wet, but it didn't last. The sun reconfiscated all of the water on the ground on the heroic plants, and it was as if nothing had happened. It was as if someone had committed a faux pas at dinner and everyone present had forgotten it in a hurry. The second was in the afternoon, a fine rain, and I had the impression that it gave up and evaporated halfway between the clouds and the earth, a weird rain that didn't wet the ground. Excuse me. The third was a storm that lasted 19 minutes, accompanied by lightning and thunder. I observed the miracle from the window, fascinated. It's raining quite a bit this summer, said Fernando. One Saturday, when everything was dry again, he got his red 1985 Saab and took me down Highway 93, hugging the mountains to the city of Boulder. Along the way, I saw a drag racing track. In Boulder, he bought two tire tubs and blew them up at a gas station, and we rode down a section of the river with our backsides in the holes, hollering and overturning on the rocks and grazing our knees. Then I sat in the shade by the river's edge and watched skaters, uniformed cyclists, Labradors, and a bum with dreadlocks go past. One day I went to my future school on roller skates, and for the first time I felt real fear, the sort that can send shivers through you, even when outside waves of heat are lifting up off the asphalt like something supernatural. It was the hottest time of day, and the public school was closed for the holidays, and its muteness evoked something secret and dangerous. Maybe military research was carried out, or political prisoners were arbitrarily held in there. One morning, a month from then, I walked through those doors together with new and old students. I was still in my early teens, but I already suspected that adolescence was basically a declared war between me and adulthood. Later, I discovered it wasn't really like that, more the simple, mundane fact that my ideas were suddenly clear in my mind, and in my mind only, while everyone else made one mistake after another. Everyone else wore the wrong clothes, listened to the wrong music, and said the wrong thing at the wrong time, read the wrong books, drove the wrong way, sniffled and used toothpicks, had family lunches on Sundays, got married, got divorced, died, was born. And check out that mustache on that man, and check out that woman in those awful soccer player shorts. My messianic wave came and went for lack of disciples or the wrong marketing strategy. It was destined to be brief. But before I realized that I personified the secular combination of Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, and Deepak Chopra, and then succumbed to the weight of responsibility and gave it all up, Fernando had already let me know what he thought about school and its dangers. "Careful about this thing of being popular," he said. "Run from the word popular. Also run from the word loser. Don't say those things. Don't think them. Don't divide the world into popular and unpopular people, winners and losers, all that crap." Then he apologized for saying crap. After 3 weeks of school, Aditi, Ramagiri, and I were already saying how Jake Moore was a loser. A big-time loser, a mega loser, such a complete and utter loser that there was no possible salvation for him. It wasn't even worth growing up and becoming an adult. He'd be a loser as an adult, too. I don't remember exactly why, but I remember that when Jake Moore went past, Aditi and I looked at one another and whispered, "Loser." I found out on my own a little later that the opposite of loserhood, the disease that all losers had, was my dentist. He had a photo of his whole family on his desk. They all wore matching clothes in red and white against a backdrop of snow-covered pine trees in a Christmas pose. It was the first time I had seen a family all together for a thematic photograph. They were all blonde, good-looking, and smiling. Especially smiling, obviously. That photo made me feel embarrassed. I had no family. I was American too, according to my papers, but in essence, I was really a Latin product. It was on my face and the rest of me, with all that insistent melanin in my skin. And I wore a jacket from an outlet to top it off. Almost all of my clothes were from outlets, the styles that would definitely be in the no-no columns of fashion magazines. But there was hope. The photo seemed to suggest that if he was my dentist, maybe one day I'd have teeth like his. And teeth like his could deliver me from all evil and make me of use to the world. Janis Joplin's good aspects, plus my mother's good aspects, carefully selected. Life is good. Meanwhile, the mollusks in the sea at Copacabana drowned out the world in their crow-blue shells, and crows flew over the city of Lakewood, Colorado, shell-blue crows. Thank you. Thank you. I was informed that we have some time for questions and answers, talks, comments, so please feel free. Yeah, Jackie?
I've always wondered what it's like to write a book in Portuguese and then someone else, when you speak English beautifully, thanks, someone else translates it and then you read it in English. And I'm just wondering what that's like. Someone else has chosen the words.
You know, it's like a different book. It's the same book, but it's another one. because I think we, in a way, we change characters when we change language. It's unavoidable. And I have been told that even my, how do you say that, the way how I move my hands, and it's different when I speak in English and when I speak Portuguese. So I think we sort of assume different characters, as it were, personalities. And I recognize the book in a way, but in the other way, it's like a different thing, a different experience. An interesting one, though. I like this translation very much. It's not always the case. I've had bad translations in other occasions, but this is a very good one. I'm happy to have it.
What's so apparent to me, because I've read the book, is the voice, the strength of the voice, is the voice of this girl especially. And I'm wondering if she has the same attitudes and the same way of the same voice in Portuguese.
I think the translator really understood the narrator, the character, and I even though I was saying that it's the same book, but it's a different one. I think I recognize the narrator there. It is as if she's able to, you know, go from one linguistic world to the other without losing her integrity, so to speak. So I do recognize her there.
That's a wonderful book. I wish I could stay, but I
can't leave. Okay, bye-bye. Thanks for coming. Yeah?
What was the origin of this character and this story? How did this come to you and evolve and end up as a poem?
Well, I think it started, of course, when I moved here 8 years ago. And the first impressions that I'm from Rio and I came to live in Colorado, so I had not the same experience, but it was really impressive to me in many ways, culturally, physically, even though Brazil is a huge country of continental dimensions and the landscape is also impressive. I had never seen anything like Colorado before, the Rocky Mountains and the plains and all that. So I was really impressed with the physical landscape and, of course, the cultural differences. And I wanted to create a character that was in a sort of an in-between place, like I felt I was as an immigrant, you know, arriving here and trying to make sense of things. And I wanted to create a character that felt the same way, and it made sense to me that this character were a teenager, because they are like, you know, between two different worlds. In when you're a child, everything makes sense. When you're an adult, they sort of do. You try to convince yourself that they do, but when you're a teenager, it's just being in the middle of nowhere, really, literally, like she was in this house with this man. So that's how she came to be. And then the stepfather, who is the former communist guerrilla, came through her, because she had to have an excuse, so to speak, to come and live in the United States. And so she meets with this man who is completely also in the middle of nowhere, because he has left everything behind, his country, his love, his ideology, everything, and he just exists without really living in the true sense of the word. And they will build a sort of a very peculiar family, and they will try together to try and make sense of things again, or perhaps for the first time, I don't know. So that's more or less. And also it interested me to study and to learn more about this episode of this guerrilla in that happened in Brazil in the late 60s, early 70s, because it's a very taboo kind of subject still today for us in Brazil. So I remembered I knew almost nothing about it. So I decided to make the character someone who had had the experience of that episode, so I myself could delve into it. Yeah?
I'm really glad that you touched on that issue of the, you're talking about the Guerrilla Guaranguaya, mm-hmm. and it is one of those issues that it hasn't been touched, like you said, in many, many parts. And I think, like you said, the story of of this woman, this girl that comes to the U.S., and this man, this home guerrilla, that it's also finding this new place, totally different from where they come from, is also the story that you hear from other political and exiled people in Brazil that went through the same time. So I find that really very interesting, and can't wait to read the book.
Thanks. Well, there are a few, more than a few, fictional narratives in Brazilian literature about people who fought the military dictatorship and then had to go live abroad, had to leave the country in the 70s. But these are characters mostly from the big cities, from the resistance movement in São Paulo and Rio, basically. And I had never read anything that talked about or wrote about the episode of the resistance in the jungle, in the Amazon forest, maybe because so little is known about it. Well, today we know, I don't know, 80%, 90%, but it's not 100% yet. So it really interested me to speak about that specific episode, because there are no fictional narratives in Brazil talking about that episode, even though we have narratives that talk about the resistance against the military dictatorship and exile and all that. Thanks.
Well, then I'm curious to what were your sources for researching the jungle chapter of the resistance?
Well, I started doing research, and I was very fortunate because I came upon a book called Operação Araguaia. I don't know, Araguaia, what? Operation, yeah. And it's written by a journalist from Brasília, and it's like a 400-page book. And there she tells the story in its most up-to-date version. So everything that we officially know in Brazil about this episode is in that book. So she had access to all the archives that the military disclosed, and she wrote that wonderful book. So that was a wonderful source of inspiration and research for me. And I was fortunate enough to be able to actually exchange emails with her. So she read the book, my book, before it was published. And I wanted to know, hey, please make sure that I'm not saying, anything stupid and that everything makes sense. And the character, this character in my book is based on someone who participated in the guerrilla, and about whom she writes in her essay. So that was my main source of research.
No, it cannot. Okay. So, Adriana, how do you feel when you finish your book? Okay, it's done. Closing, bye-bye. because when I finish a book, it's like I'm grieving. Mm. I feel I cannot start another book right away because mm-hmm. like all the things, the characters, So how do you write feels when
The Brazilian poet Drummond, he used to say that we publish a book to get rid of it. So, because otherwise you will be editing it forever, because it's never going to be perfect, of course. And every time that I that's, in a way, it's a bit painful to read from the book because I always find things that I would do differently today. Because it was a few years ago, so I'm a different person, slightly different. So I would find different solutions for the problems that I had here. So it's never done. It's never finished. So you just get rid of it. You just, you know. It's like when you have a child and the child is grown up and you say just go, just, you know, go live your life. And then the book, in a way, it's living its life. And you get to see it from time to time, visit it.
Oh, thank you so much to Adriana. Please give her another round of applause.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.